Hello, everybody. Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you happen to be sitting right now. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on TCPA update, analyzing recent legal decisions and a pending rule from the FCC, which is being brought to you by TCN. It seems as though complying with the Telephone Consumer Protection Act is always a moving target, between widely varying legal rulings, new laws that have been enacted, and a pending rule from the Federal Communications Commission. Complying with the TCPA is probably more difficult than it's ever been. In this webinar, sponsored by TCN, a pair of the industry's leading experts are going to walk us through some important updates to the TCPA and share some strategies on how best to comply with the law. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is completely free for anybody to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. David Kaminsky is the chair of the Financial Services Law Practice at Carlson & Messer. He represents banks, creditors, debt collectors, and asset buyers in the defense of claims brought under all federal and state consumer protection statutes. He manages the nationwide litigation for numerous financial institutions and has helped shape the law affecting the rights of collection agencies and creditors throughout the United States. David provides compliance advice and develops all necessary policies and procedures. He successfully defends clients against CFPB and other federal and state regulatory action. David was a 2019 ACA Foundation Award recipient, 2019 Collect Tech Top 50 U.S. Receivables Professionals, the 2014 and 2016 Chair of the Attorneys Division of ACA International, and the 2016 ACA International Attorney of the Year. Nicole Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, TCPA, in the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, as well as individuals. She's an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation in the survey helps me develop content on what you're looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from, which is definitely the case we have today, and I want to get you to them as quickly as possible. Finally, there's no slide up that mentions this, but just a reminder that this is not to be considered legal advice. This is just general information from our experts today. If you want more specific advice, please consult with your attorneys. So with that, let's launch into our discussion. Let's start with the most recent news first, and that's probably the case out of the 11th Circuit, Glasser v. Hilton Grand Vacations. Nicole, since you're up on my screen, maybe you want to walk us through that and what it means with respect to the TCPA.
Well, sure. Well, it's kind of an exciting decision to come down. So that came down, at the end of January. And it came out of the 11th Circuit. And the question that the court was looking at was the definition of auto dialer. And the Glasser case actually involved, it was a consolidated appeal of two different plaintiffs. One of the plaintiffs had filed a TCPA action against Hilton Grand Vacations Company as a result of marketing calls made in furtherance, I guess, of some type of timeshare or vacation property rental. And the other plaintiff had filed an action under the TCPA against a student loan assistance agency that was seeking to collect a debt that was owned based on student loans. And so at issue in both cases was, what is the definition of auto dialer to bring these claims under the TCPA? As a few courts have struggled with the definition of, you know, what constitutes, you know, auto dialer under the Act. And so the 11th Circuit went through and did a really thoughtful analysis of the statutory text in looking at whether the equipment at issue had to have the capacity or the use of basically a random or sequential number generator, or you know, the capacity to store telephone numbers, and whether or not the random and sequential number generator needed to be used in either of those definitions to fall under the TCPA. And so ultimately, the court determined that as a result of the way that the statute was worded, that you did, you know, indeed need that random and sequential number generator to be in place in order to fall underneath the TCPA's auto dialer definition. And then additionally, as to, I believe it was Glasser, there's that she was the defendant that was actually suing, or the plaintiff that was suing Hilton. She had an additional problem too, which was there was some human intervention involved with the equipment. And I think, you know, that's an important piece of the decision too, because not only it kind of reaffirms, you know, what we've seen in other decisions, that if there is, you know, a human intervention with these types of systems, that also would pull it out of the TCPA's auto dialer definition. And in this particular case, the Hilton employees, while there was a system in place that would pull up a batch, I guess, of consumer information, like specific targeted consumers to receive these messages, She actually had a circumstance where there was human intervention, where the employees would actually have to be the ones to actually place the call by clicking a button. And so the court goes through that analysis as well, which was interesting. Unfortunately, due to the student education portion, so that was the other plaintiff, not Glasser, that was Evans, their decision was actually affirmed on another basis because they were leaving pre-recorded messages. So the court said they didn't really need to even decide. It was really irrelevant as to whether the auto dialer was used, because the pre-recorded messages were being used. And that was really all it took for her to obtain a ruling in her favor on those calls. So very interesting decision. You know, it's obviously important because it's quite contrary to what the Ninth Circuit came down with, and kind of increases that circuit split of the appellate courts as to, you know, what is the definition of auto dialer, and really tees it up for Supreme Court review. So yeah, that's the Glasser. David, any thoughts on that? Given that it's contrary decision with the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nicole. Yeah, you know, this Glasser decision is terrific, and it's terrific for many reasons. Number one, it comes from the 11th Circuit, and the 11th Circuit covers Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And those states, especially Florida, just absolute hotbeds for TCPA litigation. And you just could imagine the plaintiff's attorneys who are most active in those states, and we all know who they are, their heads have just been spinning since the Glasser decision came out, because that pretty much eviscerates an auto dialer argument within the 11th Circuit, because right now you don't have an auto dialer, and you're not using an auto dialer unless you have a system that can randomly and sequentially dial. So I think this decision was terrific. And of course, the decision also reaffirms the human intervention click to dial exception to an auto dialer. And so basically what the court says, that when you have a system that can click to dial and it requires a human being to click in order to launch a call, in some fashion, whether they have to type all the numbers, whether they have to click to on the numbers, where they have to click on the number and cut and paste it and put it in another program and then hit to launch, that is human intervention. And almost every single court looking at this issue, in addition to 9 or 10 other decisions, have said that when you have that kind of system, you do not have an automatic telephone dialing system. So really good decision. Nicole, I agree with you. It does set up that circuit split. You've got now the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Dominguez saying, well, we think that in order to have an auto dialer, you need a random and sequential number generator. That is consistent with the with what the 11th Circuit said here in this Glasser versus Hilton Grand case. You've got to have a random sequential number generator in order to have an auto dialer. Contrast, of course, with the 9th Circuit, which says that as long as you can store and automatically dial numbers, or you have a random sequential number generator that can generate numbers and dial them, then you have an auto dialer. The 9th Circuit decision is much broader. The 11th Circuit really slapped down the 9th Circuit decision and says, while we think Judge Ikuda's analysis in the Marks decision in the 9th Circuit was very interesting and lovely and somewhat cute, we are not going there. And they just
they
said that
they
were
language, didn't they?
They did. They just, I mean, they looked at it and they said, hey, with what Judge Ikuda did in Marks and how she interpreted an auto dialer, that's not judicial interpretation. In our view, that looks more like surgery. And that was just a real insult, which is interesting because Judge Ikuda, who did was the lead for the decision in the Marks decision out of the Ninth Circuit, is a Republican appointee who was actually very well respected by members of the United States Supreme Court. Maybe not after her decision in Marks. Something went awry. But I think Nicole and I, we agree with the 11th Circuit decision. Of course, it makes sense. Between the 11th, the 3rd Circuit, and now the 9th Circuit, you have more of heft of a circuit split, and that's big. Those are powerful circuits. 3rd Circuit, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, that's an important circuit, the 3rd Circuit, and very influential, just like the 11th Circuit and the 9th Circuit. Three influential circuits now are conflicting with each other. So this sets up, as Nicole said, this circuit split for that potential Supreme Court review. Is it going to happen? Nicole and I are going to get into that as we move on here. You know, there's a good chance. Go ahead, Nicole.
I was just going to say, I should mention too that we may actually see something from the 7th as well. There's an AT&T case that's on appeal currently, where they're arguing over the definition as well.
That's eventually. Right. That's Gattelhack, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gattelhack.
So we may see something on that soon, which will be interesting to see whether, you know, they deepen the split or whether they side with the 9th. You know, and obviously we don't have a crystal ball, so it'll be interesting to see what occurs, but that's in the pipeline as well.
That's a good point. That Gattelhack decision said that you needed a random and sequential number generator, but now that's going up to the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals, as Nicole said. And now that it's going to do that, is the 7th Circuit, when you get to the 7th Circuit Court of Appeal, are they going to look at the auto dialer and try to side with Marks? It's going to be very interesting. You know, sometimes we get some liberal decisions out of the 7th Circuit, but as of late, at least from what I've seen, they've taken more of a conservative approach. And it's interesting that several of the district courts within the 7th Circuit, the lower federal courts, the federal district courts, a lot of them, about 3 or 4, have come out and said that you need a random and sequential number generator in order to have an auto dialer. So very, very interesting what's going to happen. You have one more circuit. There is absolutely no way. I think there's no way right now the Supreme Court can ignore the auto dialer issue and the auto dialer ban, and it's going to have to go up in light of this circuit split. So I think we're going to have some fireworks And we haven't even gotten to the Barr versus American Association of Political Consultants case. So, well, Mike, if you're ready,
let me just jump in for 1 second. Remind everybody that today's webinar is being sponsored by TCN. Also wanted to remind everybody, if you have a question, please hit the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel, type it in, and we'll get to it. We did have a question that came in that I think is a relatively, hopefully, straightforward one. The question is, how do these circuit splits get resolved, or can they? Is it only within, you know, the, is it sort of, does it become up to the Supreme Court? I think the answer is yes, but I will absolutely defer to the legal experts to tell me if I'm wrong.
Well,
so, I mean, that's
that.
Correct. I mean, okay. So basically how the appellate courts work is, as David mentioned, you know, each appellate court at the federal level is tasked with, you know, the highest state of the federal law, essentially, in like these particular states. So, for example, you know, the Seventh Circuit, it was the highest court for the, you know, in the federal land, so to speak, in terms of the in the states of Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana. And so when the Seventh Circuit comes down with a decision, that's the law in those three federal jurisdictions. Now, that being said, you can go down to, you know, the Ninth Circuit, where David hails from, you know, California and Oregon and Washington and
Hawaii and Arizona and
Hawaii,
Alaska.
Arizona and Alaska. You're more states than me, but, you know, is what it is. And so, you know, whatever the Ninth Circuit decides as to the issue, that's the law that controls in those states. So by basically traveling to a different state, you get a different applicable law on an identical federal issue, which is always interesting. And really the only way to resolve those differences is for the Supreme Court to come in and make a decision. And then once they make that decision, you know, that's the law of the land in the United States.
And the issue why we think it has to go up, it's not just we have a circuit split. We have a circuit split on one of the most controversial statutes in this country. You know, years and years ago, before most of you were born, I had one of the first TCPA class actions in the entire country, and it sort of woke up the entire industry as to what the statute's about. And then you've seen every other plaintiff and his brother and cousin attorney, you know, pick up the TCPA and run with it. And, you know, litigation has been rampant, thousands and thousands of cases. And it's crazy to think that you could go to Florida, and if the case solely involves an auto dialer issue on a class action basis, the defense walks out and slaps his hands and said, "Hey, I'm done. I didn't have an auto dialer because I don't have this random and sequential number generator." By the way, almost no one today has a random and sequential number generator. Those things are so ancient. But please, all of you companies listening today, in a case that I had several years ago, when we were looking into the case and going really deep with experts, et cetera, an expert found something called legacy software. And the legacy software that was buried beneath or within the auto dialing system or the calling system had random and sequential number generation capability. No one would have known that. Luckily, the other side, the plaintiffs, never even knew about that. But so this is something to think about when you're looking at your system thinking, "Oh, I don't have a random and sequential number generator in my dialing system or my predictive dialer." Well, guess what? You may, because it may be buried within ETH. So it's always good to really ask your IT to dig deep within the system. And just one other thing about predictive dialers, because someone raised the question and they said, "Well, do I have a problem with my predictive dialer?" Just because you have a predictive dialer does not mean that it's an automatic telephone dialing system, because now in the 11th Circuit and the 3rd Circuit, that system has to randomly and sequentially generate numbers in order to be a random and sequential number, I'm sorry, an automatic telephone dialing system. But just going back with this statute and the point that I was making is it's so volatile. There's so much litigation. Multi-million dollar litigation can now exist in the 9 states governing the 9th Circuit, but it can't in Florida. That's the perfect setup for a circuit split.
So
and that's why I think the Supreme Court.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, if you think about it, like, from a practical perspective in the year 2020, right? And David, you touched on this, but David and I were chatting before before the webinar today, just, you know, talking about a few different issues. And, you know, I'm here in Nevada, right? Here, you know, doing the webinar from Nevada. David's in California. I live in Chicago. And by virtue of me traveling here, a completely different law applies, even though I have the same cell phone, the same number. Nothing's changed, but my mere presence in the state of Nevada, if I were to receive an auto-dialed call here today in Nevada, it'd be a completely different set of law than, say, I was, you know, in the 11th Circuit if I was in Miami right now, or, you know, in Chicago. And, you know, we're so much more, I don't want to use the word transient, but, you know, we travel so much more nowadays than, you know, when the statute was enacted. And, you know, think about the perpetual unfairness of being subject to, you know, these very different interpretations about the law just by virtue of, you know, hopping on an airplane, which people do every day. And so I think that too, in that, you know, it's really a technology issue, and you know, the diverging opinions makes it even more important for the Supreme Court to review a scenario like this, you know, out of even perpetual fairness. You know, that someone could be subject to just very different, you know, sets of liability just by virtue of, you know, them, you know, leaving a state to another state on the same federal statute is kind of disturbing.
It is. So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll just keep your ears wide open, because we have some more issues to talk about and reasons why we think the Supreme Court is going to grab onto this statute and really rip it apart from top to bottom. But go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in here for a second. To the person who asked what circuit North Carolina is in, the Wikipedia tells me it's in the Fourth Circuit. So hopefully that answers your question. Also wanted to just jump in and pause the discussion for a moment and talk a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar, TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. Its always-on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale and adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, please visit www.tcn.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. I'm sure I speak on behalf of all of us listening when I say we appreciate your generous support in helping educate the industry on a very important topic. Now, let's get back to our discussion. We've talked a little bit about the Supreme Court, and David, you mentioned Barr v. American Association of Political Consultants was another TCPA case that has already been docketed before the Supreme Court. So maybe you can spend a minute or two sort of talking about how the dynamic of one case before the Supreme Court, and now there may be another, and how that would all sort of play out.
Wow. Okay. This is a minefield. We're going to try to sort this out for you, and Nicole and I will try to make it very, very easy and understandable. So now we have before the Supreme Court, because they have agreed to take the petition. Remember that you can make a petition to the Ninth Circuit after you lose, let's say, a position in a federal circuit court of appeal. You can petition to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court, will you kindly review this case? Supreme Court will say no, just about 90% of the time, maybe sometimes it's 92. meaning they only take about 5 to 10% of the cases that are presented before them. And sometimes there are very important cases that they do not get the opportunity to hear, but this one they are. This is Barr versus American Association of Political Consultants. And this case arose out of a federal circuit court of appeal decision from, here it is, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the question there involved the TCPA, but the government debt exception in the TCPA. So as you recall in the TCPA, it says that generally, hey, you're restricted from making any calls to a cell phone or making any of those pre-recorded messages except with the prior express consent of the called party. And they said, so if you make it to any telephone number assigned to a paging service, a cell service, there's going to be liability unless you have consent, unless such call is made solely to collect the debt that's owed or guaranteed by the U.S. So if you're making a call that is concerning a debt owed to or guaranteed by the U.S., you don't have to have consent before you make that call via an auto dialer to a cell phone. Not so fast. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the American Political Consultant case said, wait a second. That section sounds like it's content-based, and you can't have a content-based restriction in a federal statute unless it passes First Amendment muster and judicial scrutiny. And guess what? It didn't here, because what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said is, okay, this is a content-based restriction. There is no compelling federal government interest as to why the federal government is exempt when calls are made on federal government debt as opposed to any other debt. So we're going to strike that section as a unconstitutional restriction on speech. And not only are we going to do that, we're going to say we can sever that one bad section from the TCPA, and then we can, then everybody's good and everybody's happy. TCPA exists as it existed since 1991, and we're just going to remove Congress's 2015 amendment that added that government debt exception. Well, not so fast. The Fourth Circuit struck that down, and then there was an appeal made to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court took this case. And they took this case. They didn't explain exactly on what grounds, but most or several publications have said, oh, they took this, of course, only to deal with the government debt exception and whether striking that provision was proper, A, and B, can you strike it from the statute and can the rest of the statute remain? Or by striking that government debt exception, do you now broaden the TCPA so far much broader than Congress had intended when they enacted that little exception, right, that gave the government an out, and what's going to happen with the statute now? Well, Nicole and I were talking about this, and look, we just don't think the Supreme Court is going to solely limit its review on this important statute just to the government-backed debt exemption. They're going to slice and dice this TCPA in ways I don't think that we can yet anticipate. This is the Supreme Court's chance to look at this statute from various points of view. They may very well say, by taking out that little government debt exemption, which the Fourth Circuit said, oh, this is the unconstitutional part, we can just exit out, cut it out like surgery, and then everybody goes back to the way we were. Supreme Court may not agree with that, but Attorney General Barr and the FCC are pushing to keep that government-backed debt exemption in, saying that the Supreme Court, well, the Congress has a right to make certain rules that do benefit the government, and therefore that section was a proper section, and it is not unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court should allow that section to stay. I'll tell you, it's in looking at this and in slicing and dicing it and analyzing everything that's going on, they could take the TCPA and literally, with this issue, turn it on its head. But one thing we know is that there's probably one thing we could say, that the TCPA is generally probably not going away. And if the Supreme Court does, in fact, strike down the entire TCPA as an unconstitutional overbroad statute, something else is going to come in its play, because this is the exact point the FCC has made for years. Careful what you do with the TCPA, careful what you do on the Supreme Court level, the Federal Court of Appeal level, even the District Court level, because you don't want to, you want to avoid unintended consequences. And from the FCC's standpoint, the unintended consequences are that you have no auto dialer restriction, and it is a free-for-all for companies around the world, no matter where they are, to make calls via any type of dialing equipment, auto-dialed or otherwise, and to make calls to millions of people, and therefore open up unfettered, you know, unrestricted calls to cell phones via auto-dialed equipment from telemarketers, from non-telemarketers, it doesn't matter. So that's something that we have to be very careful about. So I'm telling you, this Supreme Court case right now, Barr, is going to be fascinating. Nicole?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And, you know, David and I discussed this a little bit before our call today. But, you know, one of the points I think is interesting, which is, you know, there's this whole argument here that, you know, should the Supreme Court, you know, end up striking down the entire TCPA, that there will be this flood of calls. But as David and I were discussing, don't we already have that already anyway? And not by legitimate businesses, but by people that are seeking to take advantage of consumers, ones that really don't have any purpose in calling, you know, besides, you know, something like a trick. I mean, I can tell you, I myself probably get, you know, at least 5 calls, you know, every couple days, like in between, from numbers that are spoofed or whatever else, that are clearly auto-dialed, you know. I'm sure everybody on this webinar has gotten the same calls about, you know, fake home warranties and car warranties and the IRS and, you know, companies that
are...
What
about my carpet, Nicole?
Right. Like, trying to defraud, defraud consumers. And the TCPA, I mean, does nothing to stop that, because they can't find these people that are doing it.
Yeah, that is the problem. So with the heft of the TCPA right now, you still have thousands and thousands of calls, millions of calls on a daily basis that get through. If the TCPA were to go away even for a short period of time, you can just imagine what a free-for-all it would be, and the type of calling volume that we would be getting on our cell phones on a daily basis. And let me just tell you, the TRACE Act is not going to stop those calls. I wish it would, but it's just not going to happen. And you can never find 97% of the callers that are making these unwanted or spoof calls or marketing calls. So, but I think the Supreme Court is well aware of that. So I think they have to tread very, very, very carefully here, even if they believe that by striking that one section from the TCPA, maybe it does render the entire TCPA unconstitutional, but they've got to be very careful about severe unintended consequences and what that would cause literally to the American public.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. What do you think, though, David? I'm just curious. Do you think striking that provision, that single provision about the government debt exemption, renders it unconstitutional? My opinion is it doesn't. I don't think they're going to rule that way, but I'm curious to know what your thought is.
You know, I think the Supreme Court is going to look at this issue and say, look, can we keep that one section? And is it, number one, is it going to be saved? Are they going to save the government debt exemption? You know, that section that says, unless the call is made solely to collect a debt or guaranteed to the United States, are they going to save that and say that Congress can make certain laws that do protect the government? And there is a compelling interest and need to do that, so government can literally function and collect debt that is owed to it, or else it will, quote, implode. I don't know. But if they strike this section, most scholars are saying that it probably leaves TCPA overbroad and then potentially unconstitutional, which is a very complicated analysis. We don't have time to get here now. But Nicole, I think what the funny thing is here is that the Fourth Circuit, a very conservative court of appeals, actually is completely in line and agrees with the Ninth Circuit, which also struck this provision in two other cases called Facebook versus DeGood. You heard me right. Facebook versus DeGood and a case called Galleon. So Great. Two cases from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal have dealt with this issue and have struck the government debt exemption as well. But these cases have something different. They also got into the auto dialer issue. And both of these cases, DeGood and Galleon from the Ninth Circuit, have asked the Supreme Court, can you please take us up on appeal? In fact, why don't you just join our cases, because it's the same issue, and why don't you join our case with the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal case that's already in place right now, the Barr case. So it's going to be very interesting, Nicole, to see the way the Supreme Court rules on the petitions filed by DeGood and Galleon and whether they take them up, right?
Right, or whether they really need to, because, you know, obviously if they were to render a decision in the Barr case, that may affect, you know, those other decisions that have, been rendered. We don't know, because we just don't know exactly what basis they're going to be, or how deep they're going to get into it, right? It looks like we do have a question here, which is there anything written about marketing text messages? I have some experience, some weird text messages in the last several months. Haven't we all? just to answer briefly, generally the prevailing view of the courts is that a text message is a call under the TCPA. So would be subject to the same regulations in terms of having consent, and the purpose of the call would still, or of the text would still be in play. So texts are regulated like calls are regulated.
That's right. And Nicole, if that text message is a marketing text message without consent, then it has a heightened sort of consent scrutiny, because with regard to marketing text, there are seven elements that a telemarketer needs in order to capture prior express consent. And those are pretty draconian requirements, and it, much different than an informational call, such as an airline notifying you of a canceled flight. They only need what is called prior express consent for informational calls, which is just simple consent. Do we have consent to call you at this number? Yes, you do. Thank you. I've got prior express consent. But for marketing, it's got to be prior express written consent. And there's seven prongs to that are very, very draconian and got to be followed. And not all marketers are able to obtain that. So that's something that you need to think about.
Right. And also along with opt-out requirements and that must be specified therein, which can sometimes be difficult, not only, to having enough space to say everything you want to say and provide your opt-outs, but what I've seen also in the marketing context is software that has the, doesn't have the proper ability perhaps to correctly identify an opt-out request. So when, basically the way that the software is programmed, it's programmed to opt out requests that come from the particular text, like stop texting or, opt out or unsubscribe. But if a consumer tries to opt out using different language than the software recognizes, it may not get picked up. And that causes a whole other host of problems that I've seen recently with consumers attempting to opt out. So that's another.
And there was a good point, Nicole. There was a very good case that came out, and the case said that when plaintiff opted or sought to opt out of getting a text message, the plaintiff in that particular case didn't follow the specific instructions from the sender of the text message in the first place, which said either press stop or type the word unsubscribe to opt out. This person said, I don't want any more of these calls. And then he brought a claim saying, I wrote to them telling them I didn't want any more calls. The defense won in that very good decision because the courts looked at it and said, you didn't follow exactly what the defendant told you was the exact two ways that were simple, easy to do ways for you to opt out of texts, and which were the pretty much which are standard in the industry and recognized by the mobile marketing, the MMA, Mobile Marketing mm-hmm. Association. So good ruling for the defense there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Just getting to one other issue, Nicole and I were talking about, Mike, very quickly, Mike, just getting to an issue Nicole and I were talking about that bar case going to the Supreme Court. Usually you get a court's attention when you're going to the Supreme Court because there's a federal circuit court of appeal split. But we don't have a split here in the Barr case. There is no conflict between the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit. They were both exactly in line. Not only the manner in which they said the government debt exception was unconstitutional, but the fact that they both agreed that it should be severed and the rest of the statute should be stayed. And that's why, at least from my corner, I think that the Supreme Court is looking at this from a much broader review, and they're going to dig a little deeper with that scalpel, I think, than a superficial review of that sole issue.
We've got another question on the topic of consent, asking about the status of collection calls made to a consumer who provided the number verbally or on a credit application, and what about calls to references provided by the customers?
That's a great question. As you all may recall, back in 2008, and it's still good law, from the old FCC 2008 ruling, it's not that old, but old enough, The FCC said that if a creditor obtained a number with consent and then passed that number on to a third-party entity, such as a debt collector, in order to collect, where that third party sort of stands in the shoes of the creditor in collecting that debt, then that collector should have prior express consent, what they called pass-through consent. And as long as that number was obtained by the creditor and it's documented by the creditor and the third-party debt collector has the evidence, that's the key here, evidence to back that up, not just, oh, well, the creditor got it and passed it on, but you, when you're tested, if you're ever sued on that, you've got the evidence, because evidence is the key to winning any lawsuit, and good evidence at that. So if you have the evidence to back it up, you have the application. You've got the person voluntarily providing their number on a web form. It's captured either via Camtasia from a video web form or otherwise. That is the type of evidence that can help pave the way for prior express consent. And yes, that prior consent ruling is still good law. Most courts subscribe to that FCC 2008 ruling.
And as to the second part of the question here about calls to references provided by the customer, I'm assuming that question is related to circumstances where, you know, the consumer is taking out a loan and has provided, you know, certain references to be looked at by the creditor. And the answer to that is a consumer cannot provide consent to somebody else's telephone number. So by virtue of them putting down those numbers of people that they know, they don't have the capacity or, you know, the standing, so to speak, to consent to have those numbers called. The only person that can provide that is the subscriber or user of the telephone number at issue. Courts looking at the TCPA have looked at, what did you have to be the owner of the number or just the regular user of the number? But you can't provide a consumer cannot provide consent to somebody else's number, so to speak. And that can raise some difficult issues, you know, that David and I have discussed before, which is, you know, what exactly can occur when you have a circumstance where the consumer provides a telephone number as their own, and yet perhaps it really does not belong to them. And for whatever reason has provided that number, either because, you know, they're temporarily using that number, or, you know, that's their, you know, the number of, you know, their relative and that's how they receive their calls. and issues that can arise with not only that, but also, you know, reassigned numbers, and numbers that were formerly provided but no longer belong to the consumer, and a lot of issues under the Act that can, you know, result from that scenario. And, you know, in terms of, you know, lawsuits that have resulted under those circumstances, I mean, we've definitely seen those where a consumer has provided a creditor or debt collector has received a telephone number thinking it belongs to the consumer, and that's all the information that they have, and they end up getting sued under the TCPA because really, unbeknownst to them, it does not really belong to that consumer. In fact, you know, there have been suits by professional plaintiffs that specifically you know, buy telephones that are you know, either temporary cell phones or whatnot, or they have numbers and they sit and wait till enough of a volume of calls occur to enable them to file lawsuits, and they make yep. business out of this.
That was my Stoops case. Luckily the judge in that case agreed with our position and eviscerated that type of conduct. But you know, Nicole's right, these wrong number calls, and I know so many of you on this phone have seen them. No, wrong number calls wind up as individual actions against a particular company for calling a wrong number without consent. Mm-hmm. And there are little defenses there too. If someone truly did get calls, didn't provide their number and didn't ask to be called and had nothing to do with, let's say, the scam that gave rise to you calling that number in the first place. I'm not talking about scam from the from our industry, but scam that caused us to get that number. But it's sometimes it's just a pure reassigned number. You know, the and also this wrong number, the call issue is proliferated as class actions around the country by so many of the top class action plaintiff lawyer litigators. The good thing is, and I have several cases right now, is that judges are starting to push back and look at these wrong number call cases and saying, with a wrong number call to a class, how do you ever determine who is a class member here? How do you really determine if it was in fact a wrong number that was called as reflected in the system? Because as many of you know, in your compliance management system, when you code something as a wrong number, that could mean millions of things. That could mean a disconnect, a bad number, a busy signal, etc. So wrong number or bad number doesn't necessarily mean that you called the wrong person. And courts are finally, we're pushing them. We've been pushing very hard. They're waking up to this issue. And I have a case that's just about poised to get a ruling on a motion for class certification on a potential multi-million dollar case from the plaintiff's view. But we've been pushing back vigorously, and hopefully we're going to get the ruling that we want, which is a ruling that you cannot certify these wrong number decisions. And we've seen some very good decisions come out as of late. So that's great. And it's this pushback that we do in the industry that gets us the ability to fight these cases in so many different jurisdictions, because these plaintiffs counsel love these wrong number call cases because that's how they love to certify a case. And the courts are taking that away from them, and that's a good thing.
It's all, and I totally agree with you, David. And it really, we have had some really great decisions on wrong number classes, you know, well, decisions where they've decided not to certify based on the basis and the individual issues that are associated with consent and revocation. The other thing that I think just bears mentioning on that aspect is the new challenges I've seen to standing in terms of the TCPA. Not that I really want to go down a huge rabbit hole. I know we only have, you know, a certain number of minutes left, and I feel like David and I could probably talk about, you know, standing for an hour on its own. But, you know, recently we've seen some positive defense strategies arguing that the receipt of, you know, a single call or a single message is insufficient under federal principles to give rise to a case in controversy under the Act. That would enable a federal court to have jurisdiction over the claim. And this has been part of a broader push, I think, from the defense, and really questioning these plaintiffs' actual injury from these types of violations where they can't really point to any tangible harm. And and I think, you know, the 11th Circuit, you know, that we've just been discussing quite a bit today came down with the Salcido opinion not too long ago in the summer, which held that, receipt of a single text message in and of itself was insufficient to cause the injury in fact necessary to give rise to this, federal claim. And so there's some other defense strategies that come along with that nowadays that I think in the past were not as successful that they have been now, post Spokio and some of the decisions that have come across interpreting the same. So that's another, I think, area for some positive defense movement.
Good points. And, when you're defending these cases, it's always important to look at the standing issue. Did the person suffer a harm or an injury, which is required even for making a claim under a statute? And I understand that there are certain statutes where the courts have said by the mere fact that they're alleging the statute and by the virtue of what is the harm that is articulated, that can give rise to standing. But some courts are saying, wait a second, you're making a bare statutory claim here. You've suffered no harm of any kind. Do you have standing? Do you have the right to bring this case in the federal courts just because you're saying, I got a call and they didn't have consent, yet I suffered no harm of any kind? Thank gosh that the 11th Circuit has been pushing back terrifically on the TCPA, and these are some of the defense strategies that you should be looking at. Should also be considering, especially if any of you are dealing with a government debt exemption right now in any of your cases. I've got three right now. And in all of those cases, we're going to be asking the court to stay the litigation. That's a motion you can make to a federal court, asking the court, please stay this litigation because there are articulated reasons why. And one of the reasons why is, well, Barr versus American Political Consultants, the Supreme Court is going to hear this case and make a decision one way or another. So it makes sense for the court not to rule that you're in and to ask the court to stay your litigation until the Supreme Court comes out with its decision, which is going to be issued as the latest. It's going to be this term, so it's going to be by June of 2020 that they will be making that decision. So that's a very good argument to make. We were also, a lot of people were making the stay argument because some of you have asked the question, hey, what about that FCC notice of proposed rulemaking? The FCC had asked for all this comment, an extra comment. Where are we going with that? Well, that is another basis in which to ask the court for a stay. The only issue with that is the court may say, okay, when is it that the FCC is going to rule and issue its notice of proposed rulemaking? And no one has the answer to that. And at least from the digging deep in the FCC coffers, it doesn't look like that is on the front of the burner of their tasks at this time. And unfortunately it was, but somehow got put to the back burner. And we're not sure when we are going to get a ruling from the FCC on the notice of proposed rulemaking, which was going to give us, hopefully, a common sense auto dialer definition that all of us could live with. But we don't know if that's coming out anytime soon. So, but it still is a ground and at least a basis of which you can ask for ask the court to stay your case.
The only thing I would add, David, on that point is, when you're thinking about whether or not you want to invest basically in requesting a stay from the court, because when you're in litigation, regardless, everything costs money, and so you have to weigh, depending upon what the risk is and the reward, the steps that you're planning on taking when you're defending a case. And I found that, even very, specific to the TCPA, courts in different jurisdictions are much more apt to grant a stay than others. And I can tell you, like in my circuit, the Seventh, I don't see it being, as likely to do that than perhaps others, which I've seen a lot of California courts, David, where you are, be a little more apt to it. But where I am, courts are kind of like, we don't know when it's going to come down. It could not. We're not going to wait because that could take years. We're already busy. We want this moved off our docket.
Courts.
And
that's a good point. Courts.
We're not going to do it.
Right. Courts don't like to bog down their dockets with cases that sit there. But for certain courts who want to get rid of a case or they don't want to deal with it for a certain time, you'll see a judge granting a stay left and right. Other courts will say, sorry, everything that you're talking about that is going to come down allegedly is all speculation, and I need to move the case off my docket. We're going through with litigation. In fact, one court recently said that. But the court actually gave, in that case where the stay was requested, the court said, hey, look, if in this Facebook versus Do Good case, which also dealt with the auto dialer issue, in the Galleon case, which has made a petition to the Supreme Court on the auto dialer issue, if that should be made or that petition should be granted by the Supreme Court, and there is going to be a ruling on the auto dialer, then the court said, come back and make your petition again for the stay, and I will reconsider whether I'm going to grant it, because then we're going to have a Supreme Court ruling on that auto dialer issue. So it's many things to think about. And you got to think about just your general overall strategy. Is a stay the right thing to do for you? Do you want your case put in limbo at the risk of not knowing what kind of decision may or may not come down in a particular case? Or can you so easily maybe resolve that case and maybe a quick and dirty resolution and a quick one that's reasonable at this time, is going to be beneficial to you, whereas if you do get an adverse ruling, is that then demand to resolve that case at that point going to be so much greater that it's going to literally implode the company at that point? So those are things to think about when you're also, you know, with regard to your litigation strategy. You can't just look at these things in a vacuum. You've got to look at every single step along the way. One other thing I just wanted to quickly mention, Mike Gibb, we've been talking about consent. We've been talking about auto dialers so much. Remember what the Glasser court said, the Glasser 11th Circuit said, look, there's also pre-recorded messages in this case. So if there are pre-recorded messages, the court said, we just got to remind everybody that is an absolute independent basis for potential TCPA liability, and it is not auto dialer dependent, meaning that if you send a pre-recorded message to someone without consent, there's potential liability for sending that message regardless if you used a auto dialer or not, because it's not auto dialer dependent. It's an independent prong of the TCPA statute. So be very careful when you're thinking about, oh, I'm not using an auto dialer here because I don't have a random and sequential number generator and I could just send out my pre-recorded messages willy-nilly. No, it's independent from the auto dialer issue and is a separate basis to invoke potential TCPA liability if you did not have consent to make those and leave those messages.
Well, we're just about at the top of the hour, but before I let Nicole and David, before I let you both go, maybe give you a chance to offer any sort of concluding remarks, a summary of what we talked about today, maybe address something you didn't get a chance to, but still wanted to mention because it was important, but just to kind of give you a chance to share any sort of parting words of wisdom. Nicole, would you mind going first?
Sure. I think just in conclusion, it's an exciting time to keep watching these decisions and see how this law is developing. I mean, we are poised to have some change, whether it be at the court level or, you know, through the FCC. And so we need to keep vigilant in, making sure that, you know, our business practices are within, you know, the law. And, you know, that when that law is poised to change, it's even more important to just keep abreast of these decisions that are pending. And so, you know, that's it for me today.
And just very quickly with a wrap up, remember with the TCPA, and it all comes down to almost one thing. It's about consent. When you're looking at this law and you're trying to stay compliant, consent is the key. But not only getting that consent, documenting that consent, having the evidence of that consent so that you can actually use it for something real. You could use it to defend a piece of litigation. You've got your recording that reflects the person on the phone giving you permission to call to make that call to that cell phone number. That's your evidence. And evidence is what we as litigators, Nicole and I, we thrive on, and that's what we love to work with, because without evidence, we're going in and making bare naked arguments. But when you give us the evidence, that is what we can use, and we can literally use it as a sword to eviscerate some of these cases. And the quality of the evidence and the better quality evidence, the better you're going to poise yourself to minimize the risk of potential liability when litigating these cases. And I've seen it from litigating throughout the country.
Well, David, you left us with some fantastic imagery, bare naked eviscerations and swords. So on that note, I want to thank you and Nicole again for your time and your insights today. This was an expert lecture on the TCPA and the state of the TCPA. And I hope people understand that they're just not going to get this level of insight and perspective from anybody else. This is such a moving target. There's so much going on. Staying on top of it is such a difficult task, and both of you handled this information with great deftness and expertise. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Also want to thank TCN one last time for sponsoring today's webinar. I hope everyone goes to www.tcn.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated today. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey to help identify or share any topics or speakers you want to hear from in the future. A recording of this event will be posted the next day or so to the webinar recordings page on accountsrecovery.net. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. David, Nicole, thank you so much. It was an excellent job. Really appreciate it.
And on behalf of Nicole and myself, thank you so much, TCN. Thank you so much, Mike Gibb and AccountsRecovery.net. Greatly appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. Guys. Have a great day, everybody. We'll take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.